Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast. Got a good show for you today. Scott Brooks, the head coach of the Washington Wizards, he's coming off his first season in D.C., and we sit down to cover a whole bunch of topics, from his relationship with John Wall, to Otto Porter's new contract, to how this Wizards team can improve on last season's second-round finish. All that and more in my conversation with Wizards head coach Scott Brooks.
My guest this week is a familiar one. If you listen to this podcast, I'm not exactly sure what number this is for Wizards coach Scott Brooks, but
it's the last one. I'm done.
This is it.
Especially after I'm seeing your arm wrapped up in bandage.
Oh, we're gonna do this.
Yeah. What is that anyway?
We're gonna do this.
What is it?
After a long night in Vegas, I decided to go get the
blood test.
No, wasn't that kind of night in Vegas. I decided to go get the IV treatment.
What is that?
It's this new like. Vanity thing that people do. They pay a couple $100 to get IV, and it helps you feel better after a long night out on the town. And wow. I had a long night out on the town last night, but I got this, and I'm telling you, I'm like a new man, Scotty.
Soft and too much money. They pay you way too much
do
money.
Do they? Remember, your contract terms are reported. Yeah. We've got your salary on the books.
Okay. Good point. Change the subject.
Okay. I was going to go a different direction, but I'll leave that alone.
All right.
Thanks for doing this first.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Year one in Washington. When you went into it and how it all unfolded, what you expected, a little bit different, how would you just sort of evaluate your first season with the Wizards?
Better than I expected. I knew I had a good team to work with. Ernie's put a great team together. I mean, it's not easy to draft really good players and have players develop in your system. And we have three starters that Ernie drafted. So, and you look across the league, you don't see that a lot. But it starts with our backcourt. John Wall and Bradley Beal is probably, arguably the best two-way backcourt in the league. They defend, they can score, they make plays for their team. I enjoyed the year. I thought we did a lot of good things, but the first thing that we wanted to do as a staff is just to develop a style of play. And it starts with great effort, and I thought every night we played with pretty good effort.
I've always said that one of your talents that people didn't talk enough about was player development. The guys that went through Oklahoma City, I mean, they were talented players, but not all of them were blue-chip prospects. There were guys drafted in the teens, the 20s, that you helped develop into really high-level players. Coming into D.C., your stars were already largely formed to some degree. Beginning with John Wall, what were your goals with him coming into the season, and did you feel like you kind of accomplished them? I know you had a good relationship with John. That seemed strong all throughout the year. But in terms of his style of play and what you tried to extract from him personally, what were some of those things?
Well, going into the year, when the first time I met him, he was just coming out of two knee surgeries. So that was interesting to meet your star point guard right after you got your job. But the thing that I loved when I talked about him, he loves the game. I like guys that are passionate about the game. He respects the history. You could talk to him about any level, men or women's basketball. He knows the game. But I wanted him to be a better player. You know, at that time he was going in, just finished up being a three-time All-Star. And I think he was a little surprised because I went at him. I said, you have to be a better player if we want to improve our team as the season goes on. And the way you start the season is you should not be the same player with what we do as a staff as you end the season. I thought every month he's gotten better. I think it was his first time he really had to really step up to be the leader of the team. And I thought we had some growing pains there, but I thought he's done a great job of really improving his leadership, management of player skills.
You weren't around when he was going through the knee problems, but from what you were able to sort of learn, like how much of a difference maker was it that he had those surgeries and how he was able to play throughout the year?
It's big, and I think give our medical staff, our performance staff also, it's all the new technology that all the teams are using. I really take a lot of interest in it and pride in it, and I listen to them about the player workloads and all the effort that they – or all the stress that they put on their body. So I think that also helped John to have a good year because my old days or my first couple of years in the league, we had a lot of young players. So, I mean, we went – for hours. It was hours upon hours upon hours. Even our shoot-arounds were long. As I've gotten confidence in my own coaching abilities, I understand that efficiency is much better than length of practice. And I think that helps players also. We don't have a lot of wasted time during our practice. And I think that's helped John, it's helped Brad, and it's helped our veteran players.
You call me soft. I mean, look at all the perks players have nowadays, right? Like,
what did you have?
Did you have a massage therapist on your teams back in the day?
It was called my own hands. You know, I got some Bengay, and I rubbed my thigh until the Charlie horse went away. I didn't have pads. I didn't have knee sleeves. I didn't have arm sleeves. But nobody did. But it's a new – you have to adjust. Mm-hmm. You can get on them and make fun of them like I do, and I love it. And the players, they go back at me. Mm-hmm. But I talked to John today. He had a good workout with a few of our players, Jody Meeks and Tim Frazier and Mike Scott are in town, and Markeith Morris is in town. So we had a good workout today. But I was getting on them today because they had all this cool gear on. I'm like, where do you get this stuff? I mean, every time I see Johnny, we worked him out 3 days and he had three different pairs of shoes.
Who's the guy on your team that takes the most advantage of all the perks that you always see with either the massage guy or cryo 2, whatever it is you guys have behind those closed doors?
I think they all do. I think they all do, and they're all soft, right? Now they love it. You know what? I'm glad that they do. And we put time into our practice plan. Hey, this is what we're going to do. You know, the last 20 minutes of practice, we're going to do our correctives. We're going to jump in the cold plunge. We're going to make sure that we get our massage. It's because what really matters is the guys being ready to play every night. Mm-hmm. And as coaches, we always get frustrated with ourselves because we feel like we did not put everything in. But I'd rather have all of our players healthy than maybe not do a drill or two to maybe that can wear them down through a long NBA season.
This is why I kind of scoff at, and we'll get to this a little bit later about the Eastern Conference, the Western Conference, but you know, Adam Silver spoke recently about there won't be any kind of 1-16 type of seating, and travel and player health is paramount. I just sort of look at that and I'm like, you know, you guys are not flying, you know, Delta Shuttle across country here. I mean, you're basically getting on the 5-star hotel and, you know, I understand that the NBA season is a grind, but that shouldn't, to me, be a reason not to reseed. There are plenty of other reasons, but, you know, an extra couple of hours on a flight, to me, mm-hmm. just shouldn't be one of them.
Well, I think the players understand that it's their livelihood and they have to train and be ready to play all 82 games. But I think the coaching staffs and all the bioanalytics that are out there, all the things that we have access to, has kind of helped all the coaches that allowed this. Because it was always just the eye test. This guy, okay, let me see. He looks tired. We're going to rest him. But now we kind of know. And I think it helps. I like giving the players grief. You know, we didn't have that. We just played through everything. And you know, I think every generation says that about the last generation. Mm-hmm. But with all that being said, I think it's been great. All this stuff that we have access to, it's going to prolong their careers, and that's what it's about, our players being able to play a long career.
Who was the coach that you played for back in the day that maybe would have been the most appalled by all this?
Easy. There's many of them. Van Gundy, Mike Fratello, Dick Motta, Jimmy Lynam, Bill Musselman.
Yeah.
Muss would have, like,
Bill
oh,
Musselman,
yeah. No, yeah. He would have fought me if I would have told him I was, you know, coach, I think I need a day off. Oh, it would have been a fist fight. And but yeah, probably most of the coaches.
Mm-hmm. You take advantage of that stuff too. There, are we gonna catch you in the massage room or in the cryo tank or whatever it is?
I have not
the cold plunge.
Okay, I was about to lie there. I have had a few massages by our staff.
Okay,
but not the. I should do it more because I try to play as much pickup games as I can with mm-hmm. our staff. I love the game. I love the play, but my body doesn't like to play as much as I like to play. It's mm-hmm. sore every time I play, and I need 2 or 3 days to get back at it.
You still – it's funny you say that because after Nate McMillan tore his – what was it, Achilles or his ACL or
don't
something?
Talk about it. I don't talk about injuries.
Okay. Well, knock on wood
knock
here.
Knock on wood.
Knock on wood there.
But I know – I think – trust me, I think about that.
A lot of coaches told me they stopped doing any of that stuff across the league. They were like, we can't – we saw what Nate went through there. We're not messing around with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you know, but I love it. I love the play. I'm mm-hmm. going to do it until I get hurt. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to get hurt this season after what you just put on me.
Well, you threw me under the bus for the IV, so
curse.
Many people think they got that curse.
Although if I do this little thing that you do, whatever that is, whatever you call it,
Renew IV.
Yes,
give the company a plug. The IV Hangover Doctor.
All right,
it's a wonderful guy.
Perfect.
Great company if you want to invest. 1 year with Wall, obviously you've got many years to go, hopefully, with him. You know, do you have even in your mind now about the next level of his game, where you can get to? Because as great as he is, he still is a very young guy in this league.
I think he has to continue to develop his three-point shot. And when he has his feet set and he's locked in and he's focused, he's a pretty good shooter. But I challenged him going into the offseason. You know, when you work on your shot, you got to be focused. Sometimes he gets bored because he's so good and so fast and so strong and explosive to get to the rim, and he just attacks the rack, and he can get there on anybody, and he can go either hand. So he kind of forgets about that part of the game. But I think last year, I'll give him credit. After every practice, he stayed after him and put some time in with a few of his teammates on working on his outside shot. So I think that's another part of his game. And then I think he has the strength and the power and the ability to post up other point guards, not to always to score, but to facilitate and give our guys open threes on the weak side. I think that part of the game he can improve also.
How teachable do you find a jump shot to be? You know, when a guy comes in, especially he's been in the league a few years, I mean, how realistic is it to consistently improve and get to a different level?
Well, I think it depends on how broke the shot is. But I think most players have pretty good form, and I think it's just a tweak here and there. But you're not going to be a good to great shooter if you don't put the time in. There's no such thing as just all of a sudden you're going to be a good shooter because you put, you know, 100 or 200 shots in a day. You got to put a lot of shots in, and especially in the off season, you got to do it two or three times a day if you really want to get better and you want to be a knockdown shooter. All these great shooters, I mean, they make it look so easy, but they've spent, you know, 15, 20 years of really mastering that shot from a young age. But I think there's room to improve on a lot of guys on our team.
You emphasized the relationship with John early on, establishing and building a strong rapport with him. You've had some other big stars that you've coached in the past. I mean, how would you compare the type of relationship you have with a John compared to what you had maybe with Russ or with Kevin or anybody else on that level?
Well, I think it's important to have a relationship with your players, whether he's your best player or the player that doesn't play a lot of minutes. Obviously, the relationships are going to be different as the season goes on. There's going to be times it's going to be a tough part of the relationship. But my job is to coach them. But my job is also to get to know them. Because they're not robots. They're humans that have emotions, that have insecurities, that have they need to be loved, and they need to be told that when they don't do things well or they're out of line, they need to be told that also. But you want good guys that with good character that understand that we're all in this together. And with Russell and Kevin, now John and Brad, I got that in them. They got good character, and they care about the game. They compete. They're fun to be around, and I like that. I like players that are fun to be around. I mean, you can't take yourself too serious. I try not to as a coach. I know my job is to win and put our players in positions to win, but we still want to have fun. We got to have balance, and I think the best teams and the best players have that balance.
What did you learn? Because there were some questions coming into the year about the relationship between John and Bradley Beal. How strong was it? I mean, would they be a good pairing long-term? What did you learn about that relationship in your first couple of months on the job?
Well, going into the season, I read the reports, I heard the reports, and I knew they from those reports they had some issues. But I talked to both of them quite a bit before the season started, you know, by themselves as I met each player before we started training camp right after I got the job. I knew that we would not have one problem, because they both are good guys. They both really want to play good basketball, and I saw their relationship very well from up close. That I had, there's no problems. Not one time I looked at them and thought to myself, okay, there it is. There's what people are saying. Not one time. And I think that gives those two guys credit. They're the leaders of the team. If they can't get along, they're not always going to agree on things, and they're not always going to be happy with one another. And that's every team, all the great teams in the league. But you have to challenge your stars. Got to challenge each other to hold the team accountable. And I thought they did a good job with that.
What's important? I mean, what are the kind of basic principles of a good working relationship between two players? Because, you know, look, everybody on the outside expects everybody to be best friends. Like, if they're not best friends, there must be problems. They can't play together. But, you know, nobody's best friends. I mean, none of your teammates like you as a player.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't like you. So, I'm still doing this. Because I have respect for your job and vice versa, right?
Seems to be going pretty decently. But what do they need to be? What do they need to be, and what can't they be to be successful teammates?
I think they have to have respect for one another. And I think they have to be able to celebrate each other's success. And I think I saw this right after John was like all-star, voted for another all-star. I think Brad honored John by saying, hey, he deserved it. I'm happy for him. And there was no like animosity. There was no like, oh, I should have been one. I wish, you know, he would have passed me the ball more. No, not at all. He was celebrating John's selection to be another all-star performance. But I think respect and be able to really honor each other's goals and dreams and look out for what's best interest of each guy. And I think they have that. And they're young, and that's a good thing. They're 23 and 26 or 27. I think John turns 27 soon. But it's good to see, and I'm glad that they're on our team.
The third guy in this group is Otto Porter, who was a free agent. You guys are bringing him back in on a brand new deal. A lot of money. People are looking at the money. But beyond the money, I mean, how important was it to this franchise to have Otto Porter back with the team?
It was huge. You know, one thing, I don't never look at the money because all the money's huge. But I look at the person. He's a max person. That guy is as good as they get. He comes in and does his job every day. He fits the role. He makes winning basketball plays. He's not going to be a guy that's going to score 25 every night, but he's going to do a lot of things that help you win games, and hopefully we get better as a team and we can win a playoff series and keep getting better as the years go by. But he has length that can guard multiple positions, and I thought I didn't know how well of a shooter he is, but he's a knockdown mid 40% three-point shooter and all over the floor, not just in the corners. But great kid, teammates love him. He's a winner, and you can never have enough winners on your team, and we're happy to have him. We're excited for him. I never have to pay for another meal when I'm around him.
Did you before?
And that's a good thing. That was part of the negotiation. I'm glad that he went along with that.
Okay. You know, with a guy like him, and he's a younger player in probably less form than what John and to a certain degree Bradley were, was he someone you dug into even more, perhaps, because there was so much room for growth one way or the other when you took the job?
I knew John was an incredible player. I've seen it, multiple-year all-star. And I knew Brad is right there to be an all-star. I didn't have a good feel for Otto at all. But I knew from everybody within the organization, you're going to love him. High character, great teammate. So I knew about those intangibles, which I love. I think it's so important for good teams to have. But I thought the way he's played this year, he made a big step. And this is the reason why Ernie drafted him early, because he had a future to be a multiple defender, a position defender, a big-time three-point shooter. He can handle the ball probably more than I allow him to or allowed him to last year. Maybe as this season goes on or, you know, next couple of seasons, he can start playing maybe some pick-and-roll play. But I think he has another growth or two in the next couple of years.
You have one of the better starting lineups in the NBA in either conference, really. The talent there is really good. Obviously, you go back to Game 7, though, of the Boston series, and, you know, the bench – you couldn't get enough production there, and that cost you. The numbers spoke for themselves. I think it was 46-5 or 47-5, something like that. You made some transactions this offseason, but do you feel like you addressed the issues you needed to address, or do you have other kind of ways you're thinking more creatively to try to you know, plus up that bench a little bit?
Well, I think there's always things that we're trying to improve on. I know with just like in game seven, it was win or go home. And it wasn't the bench's fault. I didn't play the bench. Also, I knew John and Brad and all the guys were going to play heavy minutes. There was no reason to rest and there's no, you know, game eight. So it was focusing on just winning that game. And we came up short, but I liked a lot of the things we did this off season. Ernie's and I, we communicate quite a bit, and we were very happy with Tim Frazier as a guard, our backup guard that can come in and help us and get our players good shots. We got Thomas Satoransky that's going to continue to improve, and then I like to pick up Jody Meeks. You know, he's a big time 3-point shooter in this league. You can never have enough 3-point shooters. He any given game he can have 5 or 6 threes. Mm-hmm. And Mike Scott gives us versatility. He has the game that he can score inside and outside, and his 3-point shooting is coming along. But I thought we've had some good pickups, and our internal growth. John's young, Brad's young, Otto's young, Kelly Oubre's young, and those guys are all going to improve.
Do you learn something from, you know, from the rotations you used? You know, maybe it's staggering guys, maybe a little bit more, just to keep some kind of offensive weapons on the floor. Is that something you, when you did kind of an autopsy of the season, that you look into the forward, that might change with what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think so. With you know, just in Brad in particular, I knew he was a good player. I knew he had a lot of good offensive skill, but I didn't really know if he can really facilitate as a playmaking, ball handling two guard. And as the season went on, I thought we did a better job of really utilizing some of the things that he can do. But going into next season, we can stagger some of his minutes, and he doesn't always have to play with John, and vice versa. They can both help each other or help our team score points with their ability to track defensive schemes that they're hard to guard. They both can score, but they both can help their teammates score.
You're one of those Eastern Conference teams. I think Toronto's in that mix as well. Didn't get to the conference finals and are now in this not a stream. I mean, you're in a good place because of the talent that you have, but it's a weird time, it seems, in the NBA with a lot of the talent going to the Western Conference and Golden State just sort of, you know, lurking as this unbeatable, you know, phenomena. I mean, how do you look at that? How do you approach that? I mean, do you talk to your guys about it? Do you think they think about it? About, you know, no matter how much we improve, you know, this Voltron is out there, you know, kind of that's, you know, proved to be unbeatable at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we all know how good they are. I mean, they've been into 3 NBA finals. It's Golden State and Cleveland we're all trying to beat. Until one of them doesn't get to the NBA finals, there's the two teams that everybody's trying to knock off. But one thing, I've been around a lot of players, as being a player myself and being around players, they look at the league, they think they can compete against anybody they play in front of or any team they play against. And that's what makes all the NBA players special, because they're so competitive. They got to this position because they think they're as good as anybody in the league.
Have you ever seen this big a gap in conferences, whether you're a player or a coach? I mean, there was the one year that it was close to 50 wins or something for the 8th seed in the West, but this seems to be just an extraordinary depth of talent going over to one conference. I mean, look, realistically, it could take close to 50 wins to get into the playoffs in the West, and you might be the 8th seed in the East at like 35. I mean, the way things kind of look right now.
Yes, I mean, it's definitely, there's a lot of talented players and a lot of talented teams in the West. They're going to definitely beat up on each other. Yeah, I mean, a few years back, I think we had 50 wins as that seed. Mm-hmm. But there's still good teams in the East. Boston is
that's right. You were the 8th seed with 50 wins. Yes. That was 2010, right? When you played the Lakers.
Yes, that was a great series. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the East still has some pretty good teams, good players. But we're still trying to beat Cleveland. Boston came, you know, got another step closer. Hopefully, we can improve this coming season ourselves.
That was your first playoff coach as a head coach.
That was an incredible time. You know, we had a lot of young, hungry, aggressive players that we really didn't know what was going to happen. And you know, we went to LA and lost a couple of games, came back and beat them twice. got beat up pretty bad in game five. Game six, Kobe misses a baseline jumper on the opposite side of our bench, and Gasol wasn't boxed out and tips it in. But that, after the loss, it was an incredible feeling that the crowd stayed and really appreciated all the hard work our players did. And at that time, you thought, you know, this team was going to be a team that teams are going to be worried about for a lot of years. And we were for a few years until things, you know, happened.
That must have just been just unbridled energy amongst your team during that six games.
Yeah,
and it was an incredible series, like a fun series. You guys, the upstart,
yes,
you know, 21-year-olds against this vaunted Laker team. And, you know, that must have been crazy just to win a couple of games.
And just like Serge Ibaka. He was, I think, a rookie that year. Yeah, a rookie. That, I don't know, he was one of the toughest players to coach because he didn't really understand English and he couldn't communicate. So I was doing all these visuals with him, like moving my hands, like rebound the ball or pass the ball or shoot the ball. Everything was like hand signals. But for him to do what he did that year and then improve every year, I'm proud to be a big part of his success. And then what he's happened in Toronto, getting a nice contract.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me a nice text and, you know, really appreciated me being a part of his growth.
Mm-hmm. Was he, when you look back at the guys that you've helped develop, I mean, some of these guys, I mean, a guy like Durant is sort of destined to be a star to some degree.
No, I think I was a big part of his MVP season.
I feel like you were the real MVP.
You heard what he said on the speech.
You were the real MVP.
Right.
That's what we need. We need the meme of
Wanda
Scott
and I.
Scott, you and Wanda sitting next to each other. Is there a guy, though, that you were most, you take most pride in, maybe, that, like, you know, that turned into something, you know, whether it's the Reggie Jacksons or the Ibakas or any of these other guys?
I loved James Harden was a big part. You know, he came in not the best of shape, but I thought he really conformed to what we wanted to do as a team, and he really took off. And then Russell, I mean, I took a lot of grief, but I love coaching him. That guy, I've never seen a point guard, and now I've been able to see two point guards that has the speed, the quickness, the strength, and the jumping ability to get above the rim over bigger guys like the two point guards I've coached now in the NBA. I told somebody this a couple of days ago, and all the old players say this, but I think I'm the only former player that disagree with all the older players. They always say, man, with all this money that's being thrown out there, man, I was born the wrong time, and I wish my mom would have had me 20 years later. I'm the opposite. I am so glad that my mom had me when she had me, because I've coached Russell and I've coached John. I could never compete against those guys. I would never be in the NBA at this time, and I was born at the right time.
You'd be like an assistant coach at Gonzaga, I think. You know, if,
no, Irvine.
Irvine, sorry. Well, I'm just thinking of, you know, West Coast. You would have been on the West Coast somewhere. It's funny you say that. We had Darvin Ham, of all people, on the radio show. We had a very colorful way of saying that he should have been born a different time. He said he's told his mother that she wished she had closed her legs for a few more years.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, thanks. That's colorful.
Come on, Darvin.
I can see that. It is crazy, though. I mean, what would I think I've asked you this before, but what would
although when I played, Magic Johnson was the point guard,
right?
And there's no way. I don't think I'm ever going to see a player at that position like him. I make fun of it. I mean, not actually. All my buddies kill me because they said that my favorite word when I was guarding was help. And I use that word always, help. And luckily, I've always had some good centers behind me, Olajuwon, Patrick Ewing. So when I yelled out help, I knew that they were going to clean all of my troubles away.
Who was the most athletic guy that you went up against as a player? As we talk about the athleticism of a Wall and the Russell Westbrook, and, you know, Magic was distinct, but who's the most athletic guy that you had to defend?
Well, I switched off on Jordan. I mean, that's probably the easy one. He was as
probably yelled help a lot in those situations.
No, it was like double help.
Screaming help.
I just ran to the other side because I knew he was going to score. That was ridiculous. There were so many of them. Kevin Johnson was as athletic as the point guard. Tim Hardaway. One of the best point guards I played with and against, well, two, and they a lot of similarities, Maurice Cheeks and Jason Kidd. Mm-hmm. Maurice Cheeks does not get the credit he deserves, and it bothers me. I think he's a Hall of Famer, four-time All-Star, three-time NBA Finals, and one championship, all-defensive team. When he retired, he led the league in the history steals, and I think he was fifth in assists. Mm-hmm. How does that not become a Hall of Famer? That blows me away. But
I agree. Dennis Johnson's in the Hall of Fame. If Dennis Johnson's in the Hall of Fame, I think you got to put Mo Cheeks in the Hall of Fame.
I think Mo Cheeks is definitely a Hall of Famer, but because he's that position, that's what that position was. He was the pick up full court, 94 feet, get his teammates involved. He can score. That's what people don't realize. If Maurice really wanted to score 18, 19 a game, he could have done that. But he had Tony, he had Irving, Bobby Jones, and Moses. He had all these great players around him, and he got them better.
What is it with older players, the Oscar Robertson of the world, and even like Scottie Pippen? Just they're so defensive about their teams and their era. Like you can make an argument that the mid-90s Bulls could beat Golden State. Like I think that's possible. I mean, the way they defended and their versatility, I could see that. But I see Scottie Pippen like on TV saying that we would have swept Golden State. Now, I've heard swept Golden State from a couple of people who played for great teams. I mean, nobody is sweeping Golden State. It's
nobody
not possible.
Is sweeping Golden State or vice versa.
No.
That would be, I mean, obviously we would never be able to know who would win that series, but I would not. I mean, it's hard to go against Jordan because he's only time he missed is when he missed. Nobody made him miss. But they're going to have to guard the way Golden State plays. It's tough. Bigs are going to have to guard guys that can shoot. But then, the Celtics, even Olajuwon, the back-to-the-basket bigs, those guys are no longer around. There's no way the smaller players that every team, not just Golden State, every team plays, they can't guard those players. Mm-hmm. The bigs back then, they all can score down low. Brad Doherty, Kevin Duckworth, Rick Smith, those guys are all, I mean, I'm not even talking about the superstars, Olajuwons and Ewings, David Robinson. Those guys are all great players, but the bigs are no longer, they don't play that way anymore.
What's the value of a power big nowadays? I mean, you in Oklahoma City use Kendrick Perkins, physical screen setter, did a lot of the dirty work. Gortat in D.C. has been your guy in the middle. I mean, is there still a reasonable value for that? Because you're right, it is, Boston, most of next season, probably going to play Al Horford at the five spot. I mean, Cleveland, their best lineup is Tristan Thompson, who's, a physical guy, but, undersized for that, height-wise, for that position. The game has changed, but is there still value in the power big man, the seven-footer who rim protects and clogs up the paint?
Well, I definitely think there's value because a lot of the bigger players love to set screens, or they do set screens, and they set great screens because they've done it all their life. With our guy, Gortat, he was the league leader in points off of his screens. He got Bradley a lot of great shots. He gets John a lot of attacks to the basket. But I think if you can get a big that can do that and also can switch and guard smaller players, I mean, you probably have a unicorn. There's mm-hmm. not many of them, but if you can find one. But I think with what we have guys that love setting screens, and they do a good job of getting our guys open, and they roll, and they get easy points around the paint. There's always room. It's just there's different ways to play, but we're always looking for threes. Every team is looking for threes, and we're no different. But I think our players do a good job of utilizing our bigs.
I was going to ask that because about what's next. Because when Dirk came in, he basically reinvented power forward. You're now a 7-footer jacking up threes from the outside. It's incredible. Last couple of years, 7-footers who are centers are shooting threes. Porzingis, I think, is going to change the center position eventually in ways it hasn't done before. Even the Brook Lopez's and the Marc Gasols are stepping back and shooting threes. Is there another kind of trend do you see coming over the next couple of years that, that is going to change the game as well?
Well, I definitely think this past year, I mean, I was out 2 years ago. You didn't see it as many fives shooting threes. Not only, I mean, a lot of times your bench five was really a four in the league, but they came in and shot threes. But now the starting fives are shooting threes. There's probably 10 or 12 of them are shooting threes. There's probably going to be more next season. I think every team is, you know, there's a lot of bigs, like Dirk, you know, those guys aren't coming around often, or Kevin Durant. That's going to be the new wave of playing. Those guys are like once every 20 years. Mm-hmm. And if you have one, obviously you don't want to let them go. But you know, we feel that threes is very important for every team. And, you know, we have to be a better, we're trying to get more threes and also doing a better job of making teams miss threes.
You know where where player Scottie Brooks would probably be in today's game? Right here in Las Vegas, a summer league legend.
I would probably be the 400. They would probably call me 451. There's only 450 players in the league.
Right? Your jersey would be
that
right
would be
along
my new nickname.
It'd be right alongside Nate Robinson's here at the summer league. Did they have summer leagues back when you?
Yeah, our summer league was in L.A. Loved it. Actually, they had two divisions back then. You had to pay, I think it was $350 to participate, and I was in the free agent division, and then there's an NBA division. And I was playing small forward, believe it or not. I was our starting point guard.
Did you shrink over the last couple of years?
Yes, right. I was a 5'11 small forward, but I paid my $350. I played in the free agent league, and luckily for me, I stayed around from morning to night. I just waited in the gym and watched every NBA practice, and I was – picked up when teams had injuries and, hey, you want to practice today? I practiced with probably five or six NBA teams. Mm-hmm. And then the director of the summer league back then, the Russian national team and Atlanta Hawks were traveling together. And we put an all-star team together, and the director saw me every single day from like start to finish. And he said, you're going to be my starting point guard. So I started, and I played against the national team. Spud Webb was on the team. I think Doc Rivers was on the team. And I had my best game of the summer. And like 15 points, all threes, and like five or six assists and no turnovers. And the next day, the Detroit Pistons and Philadelphia 76ers called me.
So there's your big
and
break.
And that was my break. But the break was I got there early, fought the L.A. traffic from Irvine and left like at 5:30 in the morning.
Did you
got
see
to
you
the
in,
gym.
Your Honda Civic rolling
no,
down
it
the...
It was a two-door, short bed Nissan pickup truck.
It's just as bad.
But the windows were tinted. It was cool.
that kind of a cool back then. Did you have like the frosted tips going on too?
In the back, I had like the little sliding glass, the back rearview, what is that called?
Oh, yeah. No, it's like something out of Varsity Blues right
yes.
there. That's... And that was, so they made you pay to get into the summer?
Yeah, only in the free agent division.
Okay.
And then they had an NBA division. So the free agent division, they announced, hey, every pro team's going to be there and watch all the scouts are going to be there. Yes, when they played. But when we played at 8 o'clock in the morning, there was nobody in the stands. Mm-hmm. There was no scouts there. And then the NBA game started at 1.
It's incredible what Summer League has become. I mean, we were talking about this before we started. 15,000 plus people in the stands
Crazy.
To watch meaningless exhibition basketball game where 90% of the players will probably be in the D-League or overseas.
Yeah, Warren, Legarry, and Albert Hall did an incredible job of building this summer league up, obviously along with the NBA, but it's the place to be. I mean, I love coming because I look at a lot of the players and, man, that was me. And I know how they feel. They just want to break. They want to get some playing time. They want to have a great game. And there's pressure every shot, every time down the court. But this is what the game is about. You got to be able to perform under pressure, and the summer league it's a lot of pressure on these players. And you find some, you know, a diamond in the rough, and you had a great summer.
You can probably, given that story, you can relate to these guys, right? I mean, the struggle. I mean, there are guys that have. I look out the floor. I'm like, that guy's been here for at least 5 years. Like,
yes.
He's been coming back for summer league for at least 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I have a soft place in my heart for all the guys. And you look at them and you're saying, yeah, you're right. I've seen this guy for 5 years, man. Is he gonna give it up and try to get on with IBM or something? But
IBM.
Oh, okay. Apple or Google.
Is IBM still a thing?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Snapchat, I want to be cool. And Instagram.
Do you have Snapchat?
No. But, you know, it's good to see. It's good to see him out there competing and fighting, because the dream is still alive until they tell you you can't be on a summer league team.
So, DC, you're you an East Coast guy now?
What is it called? Bi-coastal?
Yes.
Yeah. That's
how was that first winter? You've experienced it before as a player.
Yeah, but it wasn't bad. We had a great winter. Mm-hmm. Snowed a few times. Love DC. Love it. It's one of the best cities in America. Restaurants are great. The people are great. Obviously, the monuments and the memorials are fun to sightseeing's fun. It's every time people come out, I always have things to do, and they love coming out.
Did you take the White House tour?
Yeah, after we won a championship in 95.
So not the current one. I can just see you.
That
though,
was a humble brag there.
I remember you in a pivotal role in that title.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I was huge in that role.
If I recall, what was your best moment in that with that team?
The towel waving.
It takes that long to think of like one good game.
I didn't play an entire series, but you know, one thing about Rudy Tomjanovich, and I took from him, and he always made me feel like I was a big part of the team. Mm-hmm. And that's a talent in itself. I think that is like one of the great talents of like the art of coaching. That's hard to do, to make a player feel that they're a big part of the team and they don't play.
You don't wear that ring around. I was thinking about it. I don't think I've ever seen you wearing the 95
ring. I haven't been unemployed too long, but when I'm unemployed, I definitely will wear that in the interviewing process. I would walk in with it.
Did you wear it when Ernie and those guys came to California?
No, I didn't. I did not wear it.
You do one of these, scratch your head with the ring on the finger, like, oh yeah, just a little itch here.
Yeah, you got one of these? I haven't worn it yet, but I definitely will one day.
Mm-hmm. I would think players.
I have a CBA championship also. Yeah. We were 48-6.
That Bill come with
Musselman,
a ring
in Albany.
Does that have a ring?
Yeah, it has a nice ring.
Is it?
Yes.
48-carat cubic zirconium or what, Dirk?
You know what? I have never checked it out, but I have a feeling it might be.
Have you had the real ring appraised, the NBA championship? Is that insured somewhere? You probably got it in like a cereal box like in California.
My wife has it. I don't know. She has it somewhere.
Mm. You got to wear that thing around, man.
I know. You're right.
Coaches that have them, like they have those rings. I mean, maybe the ones that have them as coaches before. When you get a coaching championship ring, I bet you'll wear that around a lot.
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely cool. It's like, it's one of my proudest moments of being involved in the NBA as a player and as a coach, is winning that championship in 94. I mean, when you can say you're the part of the best team in the NBA, that's obviously, it's rare, it's cool, and it's memories that I will always, always remember. And I thank Olajuwon every day.
Well, Scott, I appreciate doing this, man. You say it's the last one, but we both know it's not going to be. It's definitely not going to be the last one. We'll check in next month or so.
Okay.
We're all doing nothing. Thanks for doing that, man.
Appreciate it, man. Have a good summer.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Scott Brooks for joining the show. As always, you can download Archive Podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.